Hey, Rarecast listeners, join us for Global Genes Live, a Rare Patient Advocacy Unsummit, September 14th to the 25th. This two-week virtual event will feature a variety of interactive and educational events, meetups, workshops, and performances. Whether you're a rare disease veteran or new to the community, we invite you to connect and engage with us and others through interactive activities. To learn more, visit globalgenes.org/live.
I'm Daniel Levine, and this is Rarecast.
Mirum Pharmaceuticals is advancing therapies for rare liver diseases. The company is preparing to file an application to seek marketing approval for its lead experimental therapy, Marilixabat, for Alagille syndrome, a genetic disorder in which bile accumulates in the liver because of malformations of the bile ducts. We spoke to Chris Peetz, president and CEO of Mirum, about Alagille syndrome, its lead therapeutic, and why the company also hopes to seek approval for the drug in the related rare disorder, progressive familial intrahepatic cholestasis, or PFIC. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me. It's great to have the chance to talk.
We're going to talk about rare liver diseases, Mirum Pharmaceuticals, and your lead experimental therapy, Marilixabat. Let's start with Alagille syndrome, which is your lead indication. What is Alagille syndrome?
Yeah, so Alagille syndrome is a genetically caused rare cholestatic liver disease. And it's, a mutation that disrupts vascular formation, causes quite a few issues systemically for the children who have it. And with the liver complications, it's driven by insufficient or malformed bile ducts. And bile ducts, one of the liver's primary functions is to create bile and manage a lot of metabolic and digestive functions, with creation and regulation of bile being one of them. And it flows out of the liver through bile ducts. And physically, it's just not able to do so properly in Alagille syndrome, which creates a backup, an overload of bile acids systemically. So these children, it's a really devastating disease, and these children have hyper-elevated levels of bile acids throughout their body because of this improperly formed bile duct structure. So in the disease setting, it's a progressive liver disease that causes liver damage. And from a quality of life standpoint, has a lot of terrible complications. The elevated bile acid levels lead to a really severe itching, a pruritus that disrupts sleep. Typically, these children won't sleep through the night, which means the family doesn't sleep through the night. They have nutritional issues and are typically have failure to thrive and growth issues. So it's a really complex clinical setting, and unfortunately often leads to liver transplant before adulthood as ultimately one of the only effective ways currently to address the liver disease complications with this mutation.
How are people generally diagnosed?
It happens usually quite young. And so the typical course, and it is a bit of a challenging journey that families go through to get to a definitive diagnosis. A typical course, as you talk with families and physicians that have been through this, is there'll be persistent jaundice after childbirth. And so the baby's visibly jaundiced and yellow, and eventually will get to a specialist that does a workup, and in current practice, usually is confirmed with a genetic diagnosis, so confirming the genetic mutation. But that can take months to go through that process. And as the children get older, they also present with that pruritus that I mentioned. That can drive the diagnosis. So typically they get diagnosed within the first year, but it's a bit of a journey through a number of different specialists to ultimately get to a final diagnosis.
How's the condition treated today?
Not that well, frankly. I mean, there's not any real satisfactory options available for treatment. So you hear physicians talk about a number of off-label agents that they use. And a lot of it's based on evidence of these agents in other diseases or in very small studies, anecdotal evidence. So they use agents that are used in other liver diseases like UDCA, which is a bile acid modulator, rifampicin, which can sometimes address some of the pruritus. And that's kind of the approach you hear physicians talk about, is they try to address the pruritus as much as possible. And antihistamines is another one, anything to help the child sleep, ultimately trying to control the symptoms as long as they can before potentially making a decision to go to a liver transplant. There's one other surgical option that is pursued in a smaller number of cases to try to hold off a liver transplant and address the pruritus. And that's a biliary diversion procedure where they will actually surgically divert bile externally out of the abdomen. So, you know, typically this is in a toddler where you have a stoma and an ostomy to drain bile from the body. It's a permanent procedure to get the treatment effect. It has to remain in place. So, you know, the surgical procedures that are pursued to control the pruritus are quite extreme to pursue a biliary diversion surgery or a liver transplant.
Marilixabat is your experimental therapy for Alagille syndrome. What is Marilixabat?
So Marilixabat is an oral medication. And in the pediatric setting, it's just a liquid formulation. You think about it, anybody who's dealt with children's Tylenol, it's just as simple as that in terms of what it looks like and the dosing. And it is blocking the reabsorption of bile acids in the small intestines. So it's a minimally absorbed drug. It's not a systemically active agent, which has some significant advantages in the profile. And by blocking the bile acid reabsorption that is normally happening 5 to 10 times a day, bile acids are used in digestion and then reabsorbed in the small intestines. By blocking that reabsorption, the bile pool is essentially pushed out of the body. So bile is pushed into stool, and you can measure reductions in the systemic levels of bile acids in patients in Marilixabat studies. So it's quite simply just clearing bile acid from the body.
What's known about it from clinical studies to date?
So Marilixabat has been in a pretty extensive clinical program to date, and over 1,600 subjects treated in different studies. That includes some adults and children in the pediatric program. What we see pretty consistently across these different settings is, you know, the signs of the mechanism of action and activity that we're hoping to see with blocking the ASBT inhibitor, and that's the actual target for Marilixabat. And so what results is there's a reduction in cholesterol, and that's from the liver trying to replace the bile that's clearing from the body. There's reductions in the systemic bile acid load for those that have elevated serum bile acid levels. Usually there's a bit of treatment onset in the first week or two. There's some GI discomfort because of the shift in the bile acid composition in the colon, and that's all related to the mechanism of action. That means that the drug's doing what we hope it to do and pushing bile acids into the colon. But we don't see that last. So long-term therapy, in some of our studies where we've looked at a placebo versus drug comparison at 4 months, for example, you really don't, there's no difference that shows up in that data from placebo. So we know that it is minimally absorbed. So all of this activity is happening in the small intestines, and all the signs that it is pushing bile acids out of the body.
If all goes well, when might you expect approval?
So we have, last year was a pretty busy year in conversations with regulators, and now have mapped out our NDA filing in the U.S., which is going to be happening quite soon. So within this quarter, so in the next few months, we're going to initiate a rolling submission for approval based on a phase 2B study of Merlixibat in Alagille syndrome. It's a great data set showing a highly significant and quite rapid impact on the pruritus, on the itching, and on the bile acid levels, also showing a growth improvement and xanthoma clearance, another issue in Alagille syndrome. And so that rolling submission that we plan to start this quarter would point us towards an approval sometime next year, if all goes well. That would be, you know, call it mid-year or in the second half of the year.
You're also developing Merlixibat as a treatment for PFIC. What is PFIC and how does it relate to Alagille syndrome?
So PFIC, you know, the commonality is that it is also a severe cholestatic, genetically driven disorder, presents quite young, has that same debilitating pruritus and similar clinical consequences of the cholestasis. What's different about it is that the genetic cause of it is quite distinct and different. So they are very much distinct, different diseases. And in PFIC, it is a recessive, a familial disorder, meaning you need two genes passed down to have PFIC. It is a disorder with the liver transport, the bile acid transporters within the liver. So while Alagille syndrome was a structural bile duct issue, so think of it almost like we describe it as the plumbing, issues with the plumbing in the liver, this is at the cellular level that the transporters are not, they're malformed or not functional at all. So the bile acids can't actually pass out of the liver where they would normally be transported into the gallbladder and eventually the small intestines. So that pathway of bile acids into the digestive tract is disrupted. And you end up with the same hyperelevated systemic levels of bile acids and these digestive agents at very elevated levels throughout the body, causing damage.
And where are you in development?
So with PFIC, it's at quite an interesting stage, actually. So we're enrolling a phase 3 study in a number of different subtypes of PFIC. It's worth noting that the term PFIC really encompasses a handful of different identified disorders that affect different cellular transporters in the liver. So when we say PFIC, it is actually a little bit of a broad term for a handful of distinct diseases. And we're running a phase 3 study. We also, though, have a very interesting data set from a phase 2 study that is 6 years in. This is some data that we're presenting at the upcoming European Liver Conference that's going to be in August this year, looking at the long-term outcomes out of that study. And the results are quite striking. So in the what we have called the Indigo phase 2 study in PFIC types 1 and PFIC type 2, we see in the PFIC type 2 children, there is a response pattern in some of these children of quite dramatic reductions or normalization of their serum bile acid levels also normalization of some of their other systemic liver markers that are tracked to evaluate liver status and liver health. And for the children in the study that had this response years ago, early on in the study, all of them, there's seven of them in the study, all of those that had that response are still on study. When over that time course, you know, a number of children typically would have progressed on to surgery or transplant. Those that had the response have not, and remain kind of on study with improved pruritus, improved liver function tests. It's quite a striking response profile. And so what we've done is taken that that data and initiated a conversation with the European and U.S. Regulatory agencies, and have had kind of good feedback in the preliminary interactions. What that means from kind of a path forward is that we're planning to file for approval based on the phase two data in Europe later this year. So that's kind of a procedural steps that we've set in motion that would have us initiating that filing in Q4 this year, and have a similar discussion coming soon in the U.S. where, you know, we'll see if we can actually file for both Alagille syndrome and PFIC in the same upcoming U.S. filing. So real exciting time for PFIC, given the amount of data and this clear response and transplant-free survival pattern that we're seeing in the phase two data.
We're still in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic. What effect has this had on development for you?
Yeah, for us as a company, you know, we're able to operate just for the team members in the company pretty virtually. So, you know, same as many people, not in the office, and able to continue working on development and research programs virtually. Where you do see this really have an impact is at the clinical research site level. And so what we've seen is the pandemic was really first rolling out earlier this spring, a lot of research centers just closed down to enrolling new patients and focusing on those that they had already on studies, as well as bracing for potential waves of infections in the cities where the centers are. So we've seen, unfortunately, a slowdown of enrolling of new patients, but have come up with a lot of great ways to keep those that are already on study continuing on study. So finding ways to either directly ship the investigational drug directly to the patient, remote visits so they don't have to come into the hospital. You know, anything you can do to accommodate the situation where, you know, people are scared of coming into major medical centers. So going forward, you know, one of the initiatives that we're starting up to try and address this, as well as keep getting allowing access to Maralixibat in an investigational setting, is we're launching an expanded access program in the U.S. for Alagille syndrome. So it'll be open access for people suffering from Alagille syndrome, and a lot lighter touch than a clinical study in terms of you know, how many visits they would need to have with their physician, and you know, some of the things that typically come with clinical studies typically have a lot more blood draws and data collection, things like that. The program we're launching is going to be a lot simpler, in part because, you know, it's hard to have so many touch points and interactions during the pandemic.
One of the peculiar aspects of the world of rare disease is that most conditions are without an approved therapy, but often you'll see multiple candidates in development for a rare condition like PFIC. How does this shape the decisions you make around such things as clinical trials, collaborations, the patient community, and pricing?
I mean, first and foremost for us, you know, we have from our phase two program, you know, really unique data set for a rare disease development story. And a lot of that comes just from the years of study conduct. What we're focused on from a competitive standpoint and from just the patient standpoint is to get Merlixabat approved in these settings as quickly as we can. And that's what's been behind our regulatory interactions over the past couple of years, is making the case on what we see in the 6 years of study conduct with Merlixabat in Alagille syndrome and in PFIC, showing long-term durable responses on endpoints that really demonstrate that it's addressing many of the severe issues in these diseases. So taking that data to regulators and getting our drugs approved is really the primary focus from a competitive standpoint. And as you mentioned, in both Alagille syndrome and in PFIC, there are no approved therapies. And being able to take this kind of data set forward for regulators, we think will be quite convincing.
Chris Peetz, CEO of Mirum Pharmaceuticals. Chris, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks, Danny. Thanks for making the time.
Thanks for listening. For more information about rare disease and to connect to the rare disease community, go to globalgenes.org. To keep up on the latest news and trends affecting the rare disease community, be sure to visit raredaily.org. You can subscribe to the Rarecast RSS feed through raredaily.org or through SoundCloud, iTunes, Stitcher, or your preferred podcast manager. The Rarecast is produced for Global Genes by the Levine Media Group. You can also find our podcast, The Bio Report, on these popular podcast sites. Our theme music is composed by Jonah Levine and performed by the Jonah Levine Collective. We'd love to hear from you. Drop us a note at danny@levinemediagroup.com.